It's a beautiful morning.
Well, you certainly know what that theme song means by now. That's right. It's another episode of Health Matters, the show that was created by and is hosted by Dr. James Forsythe and his wife, Earlene, and brought to you by Forsythe Cancer Care Center. They're right here in Reno, Nevada. I'd like you to go visit them. They're located at 521 Hamill Lane here in Reno. And also, you should write their phone number down right now and use it. Remember, Forsythe Cancer Care Center, they are truly the answer to cancer. Give them a call, 775-827-0707. Again, that's 775-827-0707. We're going to talk about the uphill battle that doctors have to become an integrative oncologist today. So without further ado, let's turn the show over to Earlene Forsythe.
Well, I like your eyebrows when you raise them. Look at me. That's very nice.
That's right. It's kind of cute, huh? Kind of cute for a radio guy.
What a guy. That's what we're TV, I thought.
Yeah. Well, we're on TV, too. Wave to the cameras up there. Okay.
Hey,
there we go.
We're on
AUN television as well as...
AUN?
Okay. Yeah, it's... By the way, I love it. There's these 17 television stations, and Rick Trader's in charge of them. You've actually met Rick Trader on a show before, and verbally.
Oh, verbal.
Yeah, and he's president of AUN, and he's the one carrying the America Matters media shows. Only three of them, and the three are my show, Health Matters, and Grace.
Really?
Yeah,
oh,
so we're doing good.
Thank
we're
you.
Doing good.
Well, we are.
We're very
okay,
very
Dr. Forsythe. We're going to talk about you.
Oh, yeah.
Only you. Your history of oncology and your oncology experience and training.
Well, thank you, Earlene. And we are departing a little from our usual agenda because we've had a lot of listeners call us and say we want to know more about how you got in the field of integrative oncology and what it took to get there, because there may be many teenagers or young people who are questioning what to do with their life. And I've had a very satisfying life, and I'm still practicing full time.
That's because you're married to me. That's why. It's not because
much
you're
of, much of it is due to my beautiful wife here.
Amen. Amen.
Make sure that I don't get too fat-headed. But we have a very thriving practice, but it wasn't always easy to get here. My background has been a torturous journey. Actually, let's start when I was a young kid at 10 or 12. I dreamed of becoming, actually, first of all, a movie director, because after reading the book Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, as you all have seen the movie and know who wrote the book, I thought I would love to be a movie director and be involved with the production, which was, the movie was made, as you may recall, in 1938, won a ton of Oscars, and...
Yes, but Black Lives don't like it.
Yeah, there were some things in it about the BLM is not happy about the way the blacks were treated in the movie and so on. So, but my family moved from Michigan in 1946. I had an after school job in Hollywood, selling newspapers on the corner, about a block away from Hollywood and Vine, one of the most famous intersections in the United States. And it was famous because there were a lot of movie stars and radio stars who congregated there. And I would often sell them my papers and talk to them, and I had a lot of fun. And occasionally one would take me to the studio and let them watch the filming. Or sometimes I actually ended up sneaking into the lots kind of surreptitiously and watching the filming going on, or going to radio shows in Hollywood. At that time, you go and sit in the audience in any radio show you wanted, and they, you know, didn't matter how old you were. So it was an exciting time in my life, and I really was leaning toward that. So that was my first love, was really movies and going into being a director. But I soon found out from my parents that only if you had some contacts or relatives who were in the business would you even have the slightest chance of landing any kind of job there. So I soon hit reality when I was a teenager and realized that wasn't going to be my end goal.
Well, you are drama. and I think that would have been a very fitting career for you.
Right. And I'll be the first one to say, okay, Doctor, if you and Erlene, okay, would have followed that movie career, you've got your daughters right now who would be superstars, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, well, Lisa.
They're
Lisa
worth a thousand
gallons. Hollywood, yeah.
Oh, more than that. We're so fortunate with our family.
When did you first decide to pursue your next choice, which is medicine?
Medicine. Well, it came about very unusually. I was on the tennis team at the high school in Hollywood. And one of my buddies, I played doubles with him, and we practiced together. His name was Kedrick. And I found out that he lost his mom sometimes, so he was a single dad raising two boys. They had he had an older brother, and he really introduced me to his dad, who was a very famous colorectal surgeon. And his practice was that of cancer of the colon and rectum. But I was very impressed with this guy. He just his forbearance, his countenance. He demanded respect. Whenever you looked at him, you felt honored to be talking to him. So I was so impressed with him, I decided at that point that this was what I was going to be.
Wow.
So, was he humble?
He was very humble. He was very mannerly. He didn't know me from Adam, and he was able to talk to me, so I just felt that he was the guy I wanted to be.
Wow.
So I actually teared up a little because...
You are. Give him a Kleenex.
Because, wow.
Give him a Kleenex.
Hold on. I'll have to come back.
Sorry.
Shadow, go get some Kleenex.
He had a big influence on my life, and I thank him for that. So I don't mean to get emotional here. Yeah. But anyway, that was how I set my goals on medicine. And once I set my goals... I was the kind of guy that...
you want me to grab one for you?
That I did not change my mind. I never deviated at all, even undergraduate at Berkeley, where I went. I got into Berkeley with a first-year scholarship. And I joined a cooperative house where we all did our own house clean and... feeding, cooking, everything. And the guy, it was not a co-ed house, darn it, like it is these days.
Darn it.
That looks like a lot more fun.
Panty raids.
So I did a lot of various off-campus jobs. I sold furniture in downtown Oakland one time. I cleaned offices. I parked cars, delivered newspapers, worked for the post office. One of my favorite jobs was the houseboy of a sorority. Delta Gamma Gamma. Anyway, that was one of my favorites. The girls would call me up to one of the floors, and I'd have to be sure and yell out my name so everyone could hide. But, just fixing the blinds, fixing the light bulb, whatever it took, getting the cobwebs out of the corner. So I'd get any excuse to get up there. But one of my jobs right about the time I graduated was to work for Henry Kaiser Jr. To be his houseboy and attendant, and to attend to his multiple sclerosis and take him to his pool every day in the Oakland Hills and give him physical therapy for an hour or two before we took his big red Cadillac, I've never seen such a big car, and to his office at the Kaiser Building on Lake Merritt. If you've ever been to Lake Merritt, you know the tallest building there is the Kaiser Building. And he, of course, owned the Kaiser Hospitals, Kaiser Steel, Kaiser Aluminum, Kaiser Cement, Kaiser Construction. And we'd have lunch every day with all the large business owners in the Bay Area. And that was a wonderful job, and he actually promised me that I could work for Kaiser any time after med school. I never took him up on that because it was an HMO and I wanted to be on my own, but that was a wonderful offer. So
did you ever pursue anything else except your pre-med curriculum?
Not at all, Arlie. I did play freshman tennis for a short while, but realized I couldn't get A grades if I were to pursue that, so I quit the team. I had been on a winning team in L.A., and I was a pretty good doubles player, but I didn't. It meant more to me to get good grades and get into medical school, so I did that for a while. And then I was able to obtain a 3.6 average that was enough to get me into UCSF on a scholarship, which I did for the first year. And so let's go on from there.
Well, when did you know that you wanted to be a pathologist or declare your kind of specialty? Because first you were a pathologist and then you were a medical oncologist.
Yeah, that took a little while, but I went into UCSF as a teaching assistant, Erlene, and so I was able to make a little money that way teaching my own classmates physiology and biochemistry, which was my degree was there, and I was a pretty good teacher, I thought, and they honored me with that role, and so I did pretty well. My favorite class was pathology, and that was because the best teacher I had in medical school was a pathologist by the name of Dr. Rambo. I loved his name.
Rambo?
And Dr. Rambo. And he made the whole thing very interesting.
How can you make pathology interesting?
His autopsies,
connecting the
tissue biopsies with why the patient died. Hearing him talk about the signs and symptoms of the patient and all the laboratory studies, how they all came together at the time of the autopsy and when you were looking at the size of the tissue diagnosis as well. And so I thought about pathology. It'd be fun. You'd run a lab. You'd do biopsies, so on. So actually when I did graduate it at the top 10% of my class, I still wasn't sure what I wanted to enter, but I did go in for a rotating internship. Now, at that time, I was real poor. I was poor before, but this was real poor. The dean called me in and said, hey.
How poor were you?
You mean like Eddie poor?
You know? He said, listen, you're never going to make it this last year. You got so many bills, and your financial status doesn't look too good. Maybe you ought to think about going into a PhD program. That way it wouldn't be so expensive. I said, well, let me see what I can do. So I went down to the nearest recruiting office in San Francisco and said, do you have anything for doctors getting through medical school and commissioning them early? And sure enough, they had just introduced a senior year medical school program, which made me a second lieutenant, getting paid monthly, and they were taking care of any outstanding bills I had from medical school as part of the goal. But you had to actually agree to give them back 3 years after your residency. So if you did a two-year residency, you'd own them three more years. And so that still sounded pretty good to me. So I applied for that, and I went to the Letterman Hospital in San Francisco, on the Presidio, one of the most beautiful hospitals in the country, overlooking the Bay Area and the Golden Gate Bridge, and did a rotating internship. And then I was lucky enough to get in the pathology residency at the Tripler Army Hospital in Hawaii, a tri-service hospital. where the pathology training during the period I was there for 2 years, I was in charge of educating the staff on different diseases and the findings at autopsy and on biopsy. And I got really good training. I also was sent over to the University of Hawaii to the biology department to give classes on blood and blood stains and blood diseases and leukemias and so on. So I had assistant professor of medicine at the University of Hawaii during that time. And that was nice, too. It wasn't a paying job, but it taught me an awful lot of teaching skills. So after 2 years in Hawaii, which was heaven, most people would think it was heaven, and I loved the weather, and I was sent to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to the home of the 82nd Airborne, Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Wow.
And I joined they made me part of the Special Forces teams. And when you go by another officer, you'd have to salute and say, "All the way with LBJ," because he was president at the time, and it was kind of a joke. But after 2 years there and running the pathology department at the hospital in Fayetteville, at the Army Hospital, it was a large hospital. It was about a 400 or 500 bed hospital. It took care of there were a lot of retirees in the Fayetteville area. It was a nice place to live. It was in the piney part of North Carolina. It was beautiful seasons. It wouldn't take much to make me live in North Carolina. I'll tell you, it's a beautiful state. Well, anyway.
Are they blue or red?
they were red last election, honey.
Okay.
Yeah. So I got my orders to Vietnam in 68, and I had thought, when I had been in pathology, they would never need a pathologist in Vietnam. What would you do in the jungles running a lab? Well, I was wrong. They did need pathologists to do forensic autopsies and to treat malaria and treat tropical diseases. So I ended up there.
That had to be hard to do the forensic.
Yeah, so when I was there, first of all, when the plane landed full of GIs, we were being shot at because no one told us it was the first day of Tet number 2. That's the Vietnamese New Year's holiday. Well, the Viet Cong didn't like new troops coming into the country, so they were shooting at our plane, hoping to bring it down, and we had to circle the airport for about 45 minutes before the plane landed at Tonsonet Airport. And when I got out, I threw my duffel board on the hard pan and kissed the tar. I said, "Why am I there?" I said, "That was a close call." I was so glad to be on the ground again because I didn't think we were going to make it there. So then they kept us in a holding compound for a while because we had to be well protected. These were all graded soldiers. They were field grade officers. And then I was sent to a town near Saigon called Long Binh. And because of the Tet offensive, there were many, many deaths of the GIs. I was in charge of doing the forensic autopsies, which was not a pleasant job. We had caskets up to the ceiling. I was doing 10 or 20 a day. And you'd have to, it was mainly where was the wound, where was the entrance wound, the exit wound, what was the cause of death, blah, blah, blah. So it was a quick autopsy. It wasn't like a criminal autopsy or something that you would consider a real forensic autopsy. But it was still very unpleasant work. And then, thank God, orders came for me to go to Chu Lai, Chulai, which is in the top part of Vietnam near Da Nang on the coast in the beautiful South China Sea. Actually, since the war, they've built a big Hilton Hotel there, and they have a beautiful beach, and it's actually a resort town now. But at that time, it was just our hospital and the 82nd Airborne was stationed there, so we had them to protect us. However, they didn't protect you against the rockets that were coming from 5 or 10 miles away and landing on our premises. So we were hit by rockets frequently. I had put two steel plates on my bed and was surrounded by sandbags, and when I heard a rocket come in, I'd roll off my bed in between the sandwich plates of two steel plates and sandbags. So I was pretty well, thank God I lived through it all. But that was fun, too.
Well, it doesn't sound fun.
No, it doesn't sound fun at all. It sounds scary. And that should make you cry. Okay.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, you know, in my whole year in Vietnam, I never shot a gun. I never fired. I never killed anyone, thank God. But it was one of those things you just never knew from day to day if any of these rockets had your name on it.
Did you ever see any of your friends die?
Yeah, I did. We had a nurse, 24-year-old nurse, that was the only nurse killed on active duty while in Vietnam. Her name, and I showed you on the black wall, Arlene, when we both looked at it, Sharon Lane, her name was, and she has a statue to her in Washington. And she was hit in the neck with shrapnel while tending to Vietnamese children.
Wow.
And she bled out within minutes, literally gushed out because the shrapnel had cut her carotid artery.
Well, did you have any close calls?
Yeah, I did. We were in an offshore island, Koolaray Island, treating women and children who were sent there to get them out of the way of the war. And we were treating their malaria and treating them for minor things during the day. We had a couple nurses and about four doctors, and we had a jeep full of supplies on the plane. The Chinook has lots of room inside. But on the way home, the rotor blade went out on one of the props, and we had to go back to the island, and the pilot said, well, you're going to have to wade through the water, and I'm sorry, we don't think we'll be able to get you back tonight. It's too dark on the island. There were no light, no electricity on the island. And they said, bury yourself in sand and weeds, and hopefully we'll be able to find you in the morning. But there may be Viet Cong on the island, so be careful. Be sure you cover up.
You know what, Doc? I swear to you, you have just become the most amazing hero in my eyes, okay? I mean, bury yourself, and we'll try to find you in the morning. Now, that's what you have to live with.
I can really appreciate what the Ukrainians are going through.
I'll bet you can. This is Health Matters, brought to you by Forsyth Cancer Care Center, 521 Hamel Lane. Write their number down, 775-827-0707, and we will be right back.
At a Proper Fit Footwear in the Reno Town Mall, we've been accomplishing happy feet for over 30 years.
We offer a various range of shoe styles and sizes for both men and women. From all-season shoes and orthotics to work boots and safety shoes, our professional and reliable staff possesses the knowledge to help you find the proper shoes to fit your needs. Hard to fit? Hard to find?
A Proper Fit Footwear is here to give our customers happy feet. We make people aware of potential foot problems as we're sizing their feet, suggesting the right arch support, and guiding them to the proper shoes for their needs.
Stop by A Proper Fit Footwear at 4001 South Virginia Street in the Reno Town Mall today and allow the owner Mike Jones and our fabulous staff to find the perfect pair of shoes tailored to your specific needs.
A Proper Fit Footwear in the Reno Town Mall, the home of Happy Feet, where comfort and your feet meet.
Businesses, writers, check this out. Go to lrpnv.com to get your printing, publishing, and professional services today. Need a virtual office? A place to receive and forward your mail with professional address and suite number for your business? Someone to answer your telephones? Want to rent a conference room for only $15 an hour? What about that book you've been wanting to have printed? LRP Printing and Business Center can do it for you, and they have a professional assistant on site daily, Monday through Friday. Just call 775-356-1004. Need copies, business cards, invoices, books, booklets, or graphic design to help brand you or your business? Just call 775-356-1004 or go to lrpnv.com. With a great selection of new and used books, you can get your printing done and a book to entertain you in your time off. And don't forget, you could have your business sponsoring the Bookhound Radio Show, just like Andrew Martoni, author of Little Man on the Map, does every week. Just go to lrpnv.com. That's lrpnv.com or call 775-356-1004. They'll provide solutions for your business and writing projects.
Hi, I'm Noreen Leary, CEO of the Veterans Guest House. Guest House is a home away from home for our veterans and their families who travel to Reno for medical care. Our house is more than just a warm bed. It's a place of camaraderie where veterans can find support and long-lasting friends. We serve veterans, men and women, young and old, Navy, Army, Marines, Coast Guard, and Air Force. Wherever they hail from and whatever their circumstance, the Veterans Guest House is ready to support them. The reason we feel so strongly about our mission is that we know that many veterans would forgo their medical treatments because they simply can't afford the accommodations. The guest house is one of a kind in the country, funded entirely through private donations. Want to know how you can help? There are many ways you can be involved, from volunteering, providing dinners, or supplying items from our wish list. Find out more about the guest house at www.veteransguesthouse.org. Serving veterans today, tomorrow, and for years to come.
This is America Matters Media on AM 1180 KCKQ,
a Lotus broadcast station.
The power of radio since 1967.
Believe that means it's Health Matters. Health Matters right now, brought to you by Forsyth Cancer Care Center, the answer to cancer right here in Reno, Nevada, known throughout the entire world. They're at 521 Hamel Lane right here in Reno. And also, if you'd like to call them, you need to write this phone number down. Get that pen, pencil, piece of paper, write down area code 775-827-0707. Again, that's 775-827-0707. And you know, Doctor, I'm only going to get to one text before we get back to the questions from Erlene. And that question says,
I haven't said any. He's taken over.
I know it. Ready? The question is, what rank were you in the military? And then the second one says, wasn't your wife an officer as well? Doctor?
Oh, yes. Well, thank you, Eddie, and thank you, caller, for that. In Vietnam, of course, I was not married to Erlene at the time, and I was a might major, and that was higher than most of the other doctors there because when I entered the Army, I entered a few years earlier than they did, and they were all drafted, and they were not happy draftees.
Well, why did you – how come you weren't drafted? You just volunteered?
No,
during
because,
a time of war?
Money.
No, because of the money situation. They had to. They made me a second lieutenant in my fourth year of med school, so I had a jump on all the others.
Oh, you had a jump.
And there weren't many doctors who were signing up for the Army in those days because they didn't want to go to Vietnam. So,
but by the way, correct me if I'm wrong, yes. But what I gathered in this show was that you did that, joined, so that you could finish med school because the
yes.
Army was going to pay your way.
That's
well,
the
no,
only
and he also wanted to go to war because no. It would be only 2 years versus 4 years if he had to go to Germany.
Right.
Isn't that what you told me, too?
I had the option of going to Germany, but I was kind of getting fed up with the Army bureaucracy, and I thought I'd take a chance on Vietnam rather than
yeah,
if I went to Germany, I would owe them 2 more years. And I was anxious to get out into the real world and practice medicine. That was the story. But thank you for asking.
Well, thank God you're here, Erlene.
And, did you ever see a psychiatrist about that?
We've got one coming right after the show.
As a pathologist at the VAC hospital in Chulai, whenever I had to go to my other hospital, go up to Da Nang and get supplies or go down to Saigon, they'd bring in not just a limo, but an empty C-123, which, if you know what that is, that's a huge troop plane that can seat about 200 people, and they put me in there, strapped me to the wall. I was all alone in there with the two pilots, and it probably cost them thousands of dollars, maybe $10,000, $20,000, who knows, to fly that plane into Chulai, pick me up, and then take me to either Da Nang or Saigon. So I felt like, boy, this is I'm like Henry J. Kaiser again. They're giving me the royal treatment here. But anyway, I had,
before he died.
You know what? I thought they treated him like cargo.
Yes, that's right.
So that was I had to do that at least once a month when as director of the laboratories because I had control over several other tropical medicine laboratories, and I had to set up the laboratories from scratch. So we were able to do all the necessary testing for surgeries and for tropical medicine. We did malaria slides every day. I was in front of the microscope maybe 10 hours a day, diagnosing 10 to 20 cases of malaria every day, and then ordering the treatments. So I also had to do my shifts on the emergency room. So all those things were a necessary part of my
Yeah, well,
while you take that water, I'm going to get to this one because I think this is very interesting, Doctor. Actually, they wrote in and said, we're lucky to have you make it through Vietnam. Okay, and if you had to do it again, Earlene, let me ask you this while we watch him pass away.
Do you need CPR over there?
Yeah.
Do you know how to do it, Eddie?
No, I'm not doing it. You're going to have to do it.
These war stories get me all choked up.
I'll take the mouth, and you do the chest.
I'll do the chest. You do the mouth. I'm not doing the mouth. Okay, but you know what?
Something this about is the war stories. My PTSD.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Well, but anyway. What were you going to ask me?
Well, no, I was going to tell him a comment. This comes from Bert in Salt Lake City. Bert writes in and says, Dr. Forsythe and Earlene, thank you both for your service. Thank you for listening to Health Matters.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And, yeah, we can't forget my wife because she was at home here in Reno in the reserve area. She had signed up herself. She wanted to go to Vietnam, but they wouldn't let her. They thought
it
would
be shrink too.
Too distracting. It would be too distracting for the other GIs to have her there. So she was kept here doing her duties here at the Reserve Hospital.
You know, Earlene, my youngest son owns Sierra Therapy here, and I can get you a family
Thank
discount.
You. Okay. Can you?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's sort of crazy.
So, yeah, we did a little of everything in those laboratories, and we, as I said, malaria, more GIs were dying of malaria or getting sick with malaria than they were getting gunshot wounds and healing from those. So that was a very important thing. And, of course, I was also in charge of handing out hydroxychloroquine. Remember that drug that is used for COVID and Trump?
Right.
Well, we had all the GIs on one 200-milligram tablet a week to prevent malaria, and it was working.
You know what? This comes from Bill down in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bill writes in and says, I'm glad that you were the doctor because I'm sure, and you just got through verifying, he said, I'm sure you used ivermectin. Were there any side effects?
Well, not ivermectin, but hydroxychloroquine. And ivermectin was is a horse dewormer. That was not used except by the veterinarians.
So hydroxychloroquine was the one, so we'll tell him. Okay, but any side effects on that one, Doctor?
Not at all. We had there were 400,000 troops in Vietnam. I was there at the very peak of the troop buildup by Johnson, and we were ordered to hand these out once a month while they were in country to prevent malaria, but it's still many of the GIs, of course, did not take it. They told me personally they'd rather have malaria than die in the swamps, and that was not a popular war. Let's face it.
Right.
Okay. No, it wasn't. All right. You already answered me. Were there any close calls?
I did. Were there any close calls? Yes, we talked about that. Let's see. Like all civilian hospitals, we were open for business 24/7. We were working 10-hour days, 7 days a week. What little time we had off, we either went down surfing at the beach. We went spear hunting.
You had a tin pack, I heard, in blonde hair.
We had
that would be the day.
We did spear gunning, and they had an old boat there that was about a 18-footer that we ran out to the sea in. And one time the centerboard got stuck with sand, and we were heading right for the Viet Cong side of the island. So we had to all get together and hammer the centerboard down so we could turn it around.
Wow!
If anyone knows about sailing, you know what I mean. So the it was hard working 7 days a week to 12 hours a shift and treating gunshot wounds, amputations, head injuries, tropical diseases, including malaria, of course. That was the main one. And we had lots of surgery going on for the injured from gunshot wounds. If they were serious cases, we had to evac the GI down the line to a field hospital, usually from because we were on evac, the next in line would be a field hospital, and we had to send them usually to Saigon to the third field hospital. And if they were too sick for that, in that hospital, and there were no doctors smart enough to treat them there, or trained enough, I should say, they would be sent to Japan or the Philippines as the next step. And then if they couldn't treat them there, they were too complicated, they would be sent back to usually Letterman Army Hospital or Hawaiian Tripler Army Hospital as the final destination. Those are general hospitals. So that's how the chain of command went with the evacuation of our troops. And we've had that in every war, of course, where you have a chain of sort of force the surgical hospital up front, the MASH unit, and then to the evac, and then on down the line to the field hospital, and then the general hospital.
Wow. You know what? Before we get to Erlene's next question, I want to thank Johnny in Gilbert, Arizona, for always listening. He says, I never miss Health Matters. What was your experience with Agent Orange, Dr. Forsythe?
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much for that. I didn't really get a whiff of that until my last month there, but I woke up one morning and the nice jungle hillside looking into the South China Sea had turned brown overnight because a wisecracker in the command position thought that the Viet Cong had a navy. Well, they didn't have a navy because they have little round boats that held one or two people for fishing boats. They did not have a navy.
Did they have a submarine?
But they thought that they were going to attack us from the sea. All they did was spray the plants on the side of the mountain up to our hospital and turn it brown, and they did it at night so not to attract any attention. But when you woke up to a brown hillside in the morning and you knew you'd been inhaling Agent Orange all night, you started to worry.
Wow.
So thank you for that question.
Yeah, thank you for listening, Johnny. Now back to Erlene.
Well, I remember that your liver tests were really high.
Yeah, actually, I did have abnormal liver tests for 10 years afterward. But thanks to my wife and her vitamin program, I got rid of that. Thanks to milk thistle, selenium, and
Alpha lipoic acid
was all my B complex. Mm-hmm. So she got me through that, and thank God for that, because there were a lot of cases of cancer of various types.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, after returning home in 1970, what was your next plans?
Okay, after in 70, I came back. I had a little PTSD. I was also sent to the a Presidio again. This is my third round at the Presidio now. And at that time, I was made Assistant Chief of Pathology at Letterman Army Hospital for my remaining 6 months of duty. And so I became very familiar to me. But it's funny, on the Presidio, they have a cannon that goes off at 6 o'clock. Well, when you're in a military setting, when you hear a big bang from a cannon or a gun, your only thought is to hit the ground as fast as possible. So I was with some friends coming out of the officers' club one night, about 6 o'clock, when the cannon blew up. And just instinctively, they were all walking along. I suddenly hit the ground. They looked at me like, well, did he have a heart attack or what happened to this guy? I was just ducking because it got into your mind so much that you hear a big bang, you go down.
Yeah. Amen.
And that's what you do. You still do that today, incidentally, if you're in a situation.
Is that why I find you under the bed so often?
Under two sheets of metal.
I'm giving away all my secrets.
With sandbags.
Now.
That's right, sandbags.
I had to tell all my little old grandboys about this, and they just were laughing their head off. I knew I had 6 months to go in the military. I didn't know for sure what I wanted to do, but I did have the Army's educational program that I hadn't spent. So I knew that I didn't really want to be a pathologist all my life. I like people. I don't really like working in the labs all that much, although it was very interesting. I did learn a lot. But I wanted to be a people doctor, so I did an internal medicine residency in San Francisco. And then from there, because I knew at that time that I liked hematology, and remember, in those times, there really wasn't much oncology. In fact, I never heard the word in medical school. The hematologists were seeing all the cancers, and frankly, there weren't many effective drugs to treat any cancer with. There were some for Hodgkin's disease, some for chronic leukemias, some for testicular and placental cancers, but not a whole lot else. Hodgkin's disease was when they first started using multiple drugs like MOP and COP, and then if you got FLOP, then you knew you were in trouble.
Whoa.
FLOP.
What about CHOP?
CHOP was one. CHOP came a little later.
Oh, it did. Okay, so then you went, decided to go into an area where you wanted to talk to people. The best part of your medicine is your bedside manner, so I'm surprised you were stuck with people who couldn't talk back to you.
They better not. If they did,
therapist again. We have to go see our therapist again.
I'd be running down the room.
He might have heard them. That's the scary part.
If they rolled over in the refrigerator. I was out of there in a hurry.
By the way, as we take a little levity here, a little levity break, this comes from Dan. And Dan says to you, he's from Las Vegas. He said, I love the show. Let me ask you the following. I never got afraid in Vietnam until 1 week before I was coming home. Did you experience that same feeling?
Oh, like you would never make it home?
Yeah. I probably did. I didn't realize that I knew I had a date of departure, and there was a doctor in our hospital who unfortunately got on a plane the day he was to go home, and it went down malfunction. He had to take a helicopter first and then get to another place where he took a flight, but he never made it to the other plane. He was killed in the air from. And I kept thinking about that because I had known this guy at Fort Bragg he was a urologist, but he died, and I know he had a big family too. Oh, so that was very
sad,
hard,
very sad.
And then when I did come home, I made the error of stopping off in Hawaii, and seeing I was an only child, my mom thought I was getting home on a certain date. When I didn't show up at the time she thought I should. And she heard about some accidents over in Vietnam where more people were killed. And poor thing, I found her in a bar in San Francisco.
Found her.
Three sheets to the wind. Because she thought for sure that little Jimmy went down.
Or maybe she heard you made it.
That might have been it.
Maybe he never thought of that.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll have another.
She recovered in a hurry. That's okay. A true story, incidentally. So why did I pick oncology? A lot of people ask me that because I had a great background in pathology, both at in my training at Tripler in Hawaii and in Fort Bragg. I was in charge of the laboratories, and I did a lot of teaching. So I was board certified for clinical and anatomic pathology. And I loved diagnosing things under the microscope as well. And it was good for any cancer field. I knew if I went into oncology, which is a new field, in fact, they didn't give the first boards in oncology to my first year of residency in 71. So that was the first year they gave the boards. And we had a group of doctors training with me who all ended up as head of university treatment programs in cancer, and very famous people. You won't know the names, so I'm not going to go into that, but they were at UCLA, University of Arizona, Washington, and because the program at UCSF, which was one of the top 10 medical schools, and their training program was excellent. So I feel very blessed to have had the camaraderie with those gentlemen.
In the 70s, how many chemo drugs were available to treat cancers?
We had very few. Now there are hundreds. As you know, Arlene, there's 80 of regular chemotherapy agents now. At the time, there were only a dozen. There were the most treatable cancers at that time were chronic lymphocytic leukemia, chronic myelogenous leukemia, Hodgkin's disease, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, early breast cancer, testicular cancers, choriocarcinomas, and cancers of the placenta, which are called choriocarcinomas. The most difficult cancers were, there was almost nothing that would hold them for even a few months. And that included pancreatic cancers, gastric, esophageal, biliary cancers, sarcomas, brain cancers, uterine and cervical cancers. These are all stage four now. Ovarian cancers four, lung cancers, both the small cell and large cell, and the oat cell, we call them, and the adenocarcinomas. There was virtually nothing that was successful in those days. Melanomas that were in the lungs, liver, or brain, almost impossible to treat. And those were in the days when the mastectomies were considered a radical mastectomy, not a modified radical. In a radical, they go right down to the prepectoral fascia, or the tissue covering the ribs, and then the woman almost always ended up with a skin graft from their thigh or back or wherever they could get a decent skin graft to cover the site, because it never was an attractive outcome. And reconstruction following mastectomy was unheard of in those days.
Okay, when you decided as a fully conventional oncologist that full-dose, toxic, one-size-fits-all chemotherapy was seeing poor results after 5 years of treatment, what did you do?
Well, I realized that I wasn't hitting a lot of home runs, and no one else was, because we were all doing conventional, by the book, we called it Betty Crocker medicine, where the same drugs for every cancer were used. The doses were just varied because of height and weight, the total body surface area measurements. So I began counting up my successes after 5 years and seeing articles written in survival studies showing that in the United States and in Australia, they were getting very poor results, 2.3% in Australia, 2.1% in America were the outcomes of hundreds of patients in retrospective studies. I noticed in Reno, where we had homeopaths and naturopaths at the time, they were hitting more home runs than we were with natural treatments and supplements, and not the cut, burn, and poison that we were told were the best. So that's how I got interested in widening my treatment possibilities and going for my homeopathic boards, which I did through the British School of Homeopathy.
So a lot of oncologists get burnout. Have you ever thought that you were being?
I have never.
Going in that direction?
I've never ever felt that I had burnout in oncology, because the successes more than made up for any of the patients that didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And I always put my faith in being able to help them in some way, even to buy time and quality of life. I thought were worthwhile, because let's face it, all any of us have on this earth is time to enjoy your family, and enjoy the beauty of living. But we see in our current study of 2,000 patients at 10 years, we're seeing survival rates in the late 60s. 68 is the current one. And remember, in the conventional literature, they're only hitting 2% at 5 years. We're hitting 68% at 10 years.
And that is because, what, you're double boarded and you're able to do your homeopathic license?
Because we never do the full-dose chemo. I don't think it should ever be done by anyone anymore. We do homeopathic dosing with insulin. The insulin enables the treatment to go to the cancer cells preferentially and leave your normal cells alone. And so our patients do not get hair loss, chemo brain, neuropathies, cytopenias, damage to the heart muscle, the liver, the kidneys. And their quality of life is so much better. It's incredible to see the difference. So I would never go back to full-dose chemo. And my pet peeve is to also get the pediatric oncologist to please look into the feasibility of doing low-dose chemo on those poor kids that lose their eyebrows, lose their all their body hairs, large, often malfunctioning hearts. Their growth is stunted. They get oftentimes severe infections and bleeding problems, low platelet counts, etc.
Wow. You know, Doctor, I'm going to take this last minute, if you don't mind, and give our viewers and listeners a personal experience. As you know, I went over there when I first started writing the book about cancer called The Answer to Cancer, and that is Forsyth Cancer Care Center. You have clients from all around the world. You truly are, in my mind and everybody's mind who's ever been there, the number one oncologist, Dr. Forsyth, in the world. And you have a beautiful lady right behind you there.
I sure
in
do.
Her
thank
lead.
You.
Yeah, it's a true story.
Jesus.
So remember, if you'd like to get involved, give them a call. It's 775-827-0707. Forsyth Cancer Care Center again, 775-827-0707. We'll see each and every one of you next week.